Hi, everyone.
Oops, hello, good afternoon.
There we go. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon.
Hey, Ben.
Hi.
What the heck?
Yvette, are you the one with the beach? No, there you are. Okay, so I renamed you wrong.
Hi, Carol.
Hey there. Got a haircut.
Hey.
The day before they closed everybody.
Oh yeah.
Order at 12:02 p.m. Is there a motion to approve the agenda?
I motion to approve.
Is there a second?
A second. This is Carol.
Okay. And is there a motion to approve the meeting minutes from November 10th, 2020?
I so move. Someone else is getting an emergency alert.
It keeps on going off. It went off on my Samsung too. I don't know. Okay, so that was approved. So at this time, comments from the audience may be made on items not listed on the agenda that are of public interest and within the subject matter jurisdiction of the district. The committee has a policy of limiting speakers to not more than 3 minutes. The committee cannot take actions on the items not listed on the agenda. Public input may be offered on agenda item when it comes up for discussion and or action. Is there any public comments at this time? Hearing none, I'll move on to old business. Number one is funding request schedule. I believe the information's in the packet. Does anyone have any questions about this?
Sorry. Yes, all of it, right? The blue, the orange, and the green. Where am I?
Okay, sorry. Karen.
I didn't write my notes in a separate document the way I normally do. So now I'm having trouble finding
them.
I had a question about the One Future Coachella Valley. Their like hour notes are very short on that end. The project is pretty large. And so I don't know if I'm not finding it, but there's nowhere where it says like kids not being in school will not allow us to create a behavioral health pathway. Am I missing something? Did they not share that?
So you're not on the funding request update, you're on the progress report update instead?
Sorry, where am I?
Which is the second item?
Correct.
V252, okay.
I skipped ahead.
So let me see, One Future, you are asking what now, Karen? I'm sorry.
Their request for funds was to help create a behavioral health pathway.
That's correct.
And since school has not been physically in session, I'm wondering if they're on track or not on track?
They are on track because a lot of the teachers that are working with the behavioral health career pathway are working virtually with their students.
Okay.
The high school students are pretty compliant when it's coming to the virtual work.
Okay. And that was it. I think I had another question. Sorry, going back to the grant request pending applications, the well in the desert, can you tell me what those $5,000, like what exactly they applied for?
It's a mini grant that she's applying for costs associated with running her cooling and warming center, in specific food and food containers.
Okay. Do you all have an update for us regarding their audit?
She has received, she's going to be receiving funding, I believe, from Regional Access Project Foundation for them to conduct the audit.
Okay.
Thank you. I haven't heard anything on if it's in process or if they've engaged anybody or not.
Thank you. I appreciate you all working with them to help them get to that conclusion.
Any other questions?
One more. Clínica de Salud del Pueblo, I know they've withdrawn their application, but can you tell me what an ID Now testing program is?
I think Conrado would be best to answer that one because that's that rapid retest, but.
Yes, ID Now is a rapid COVID-19 antigen test that is made by pharmaceuticals. Okay. And the reason why they withdrew their application is because Abbott has been unable to fulfill orders for a region. So we don't have, at this point, we don't have any rapid testing available. We're working to get another brand, which is made here in California. It's called Cifid, and it's made by a lab that is affiliated with Stanford University.
Thank you. I didn't want to assume that's what it was, so I figured I would ask. And then I do have one more question about CVAG's $700,000 request. Is this the normal funding that we would give to our homeless project, which is like a yearly $1 million? Is this something completely different?
This is something that when the West Valley West Valley Homelessness Initiative was developed by the foundation, our foundation back in 2016, I believe it was, when we put $1 million towards it, and then $2 million. And then we challenged other cities that we would match $103,000 each from each city. After that, in some cities stepped up, not all of them. And the $103,000 was actually the number that came up, what used to support Roy's. Every city was going to support Roy's for $103,000 a year for 10 years. About five or six cities, I believe, stepped up to that challenge that year. Then the next year was $100,000 that we matched. And then there was eight cities, I believe, that came to the plate on that one. We didn't do anything for the following year, but now they're coming back and asking for another $700,000, anticipating that they would ask the cities for $100,000 each and that we would match it again. They always came in the form of a letter. But for equity and transparency purposes and for other grantees that are applying for grants, that we ask them to come back with a letter of interest rather than just come forward with another letter again. Conrado and I will be, and Megan will be meeting because we do have some concerns and some questions regarding this, considering that Greg Rodriguez had gotten the approval from the executive committee of CVAG to disallow the collaborative that was happening under the Barbara Poppy recommendations and to allow more fall in line with the County of Riverside. So if this is all gonna be aligned with the County of Riverside, you know, why do they still need our matching dollars? Because they took everything in house now Path of Life is not administering the program anymore. CVAG took it under into their house and hired three more people. So there's a lot of questions that we need to talk to Greg about. Did I answer your question? I kind of went around and around on that one.
Yes.
Sorry.
In our last board meeting, Greg, during the foundation presentation, was like sharing what you just shared. So mm-hmm. I really was not sure why or where this letter was coming from, and then where this money was going to, like what line item of whose budget this would fall under.
Yeah, it's going to be under the CVAG budget.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Does anybody else have any more questions? No. I think we just went through 1, 2, and 3, right?
We didn't do the grant payment schedule.
Okay. So moving on to grant payment schedule. It is in your packet. Does anyone have questions about this information?
No.
Hearing none, I'll move on to program staff updates. Number one, Coachella Valley Housing Catalyst Fund, a bold housing investment solution, Live to Rise, and Riverside County Housing Authority. Who will be providing information about this?
So we have Heather Bicona has joined us in the meeting, and they will have a brief presentation and are available to us for questions. As you may recall, we had a special meeting, a workshop on the huge need we have for affordable housing in Coachella Valley and how housing is one of the key social determinants of health that we believe has a tremendous impact in Coachella Valley, is part of that continuum that ends up with homelessness. And if we want to go upstream to promote better health outcomes in Coachella Valley for all, this is something that, in my views, is important for us to pay attention to and explore in which way the district can be supportive of this initiative. So we invited Heather, as it was the request from the board, to continue working on addressing this point, this topic, through committees. So we invited them to participate in today's program committee, and they will also be working with the F&A committee to address some of the legal questions that our legal counsel had regarding this funding mechanism. Heather?
Hi, thank you, Conrado. Oh, wait, I'm on. I don't know how to make myself not be on not video.
Your voice is on. We cannot see you though.
Okay. Hi, I'm here. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Hi. Also, I just want to note, Andrea, that my colleagues, Adicelli, Mike Walsh, and Nancy Andrews are also on the line. And if it's possible for them to be able to talk too, that would be super helpful. Thank you. Andrea, would it be possible also to share screen? For me to share screen? Do I just have to
hit Yes, them? Let me go ahead and make you a co-host. And there you go.
Okay. Is it that one? Okay. All right, this is the first time I've successfully ever shared my screen in a meeting. So thank you, Andrea. So yes, as Conrado mentioned, we were really thrilled to be able to join all of you in a housing workshop to talk about the Coachella Valley Housing Catalyst Fund and how we see This is a critical collaborative investment for our region. I'm not sure if folks might have seen last week, Treasurer Fiona Ma wrote an op-ed about the housing fund. It was published in CalMatters and a number of other places. I'll drop the link to that in the chat. As Conrado mentioned, this work is really rooted in the work that's been ongoing so far across the last 9 months in COVID. And I think many of you know, and Director Borja, we called into the meeting of the City of Indio the other night, housing precarity is at an all-time high. We came into the office this weekend to sit down together and think about what could we possibly do in this moment as this current shutdown leaves folks in increasing housing precarity. And for full transparency, Lift Her Eyes has about $4 million left of rental assistance funding. We can probably support about 1,000 households. Today, we probably have about 2,500 applications under review. And there's not a day that folks aren't lining up outside of our office. The applications are growing and growing. So in the time of COVID, but before COVID, we know that folks' housing instability is absolutely a root cause driver of so many other elements of greater instability, and particularly has really consequential negative impacts on health. So the folks I mentioned, not our whole team is on the phone, but we have Adeseli and Mike and Nancy. We talked about in the housing workshop, I don't want to completely go through the whole thing again, because I know most of you were there. I want to just quickly hit on a few points and then open up and ask for questions and underscore a few things that we think are really important. One thing is to say that this solution, this fund, is not something we just thought of this year. It's something that we've been building the groundwork towards for 3 years, because what we recognize, especially now, as all of us, and especially the healthcare district, who's generously invested in the multiple stabilizing solutions that are happening in the community right now, we have to leverage our resources and use them in a way that moves us from operating in a frame of charity to operating in a more sustainable and just way. And so one of the things we know is that the cash assistance and the rental assistance, it's not bad, but it's not a solution. And a solution really is creating a permanent investment vehicle that allows for more housing to occur, and for it to occur and be built in a way that centers and drives community priorities. So it's taken a couple of years for us to get here. The ultimate goal is to increase the supply of housing by 10,000 units, which would and should reduce the level of rent burden in the population by 30%. Again, that's only by 30%, but I think folks know from looking at earlier data, we're really trying to increase production from an abysmal less than 100 units a year to really get us to almost 1,000 units a year. So the Coachella Valley Housing Catalyst Fund will ultimately leverage about $100 million in capital to drive the first 2,000 units of housing, and it will operate as a revolving fund and continue across at least the next 10 years to drive units and make it possible for construction to occur. I'm not really going in order through the deck. Just a few things to highlight is that we know that the impacts of housing stability on folks in our community are severe. And we know that this is really, like Conrado said, planning for and advanced planning for the built environment and housing allows us to really get upstream and mitigate, especially some of the early impacts that we see that are lifelong for young children in our community. We've shared this data with you before about what happens when folks are living in housing that they can afford, why it's a social determinant of health, very broadly, not just the healthcare district, but dozens and dozens of healthcare actors across the country are substantially investing in affordable housing now, as research strongly shows that it's a really, really strong predictor for preventing negative health outcomes. I'm going to skip down to the solution. So one thing, we've had a lot of questions since the last workshop of exactly how the fund will work. And Nancy's on the phone, and I'll pause for questions and let her and Mike jump in here. But just to say that the housing fund is part of a comprehensive agenda and solution. So there's a number of policy barriers in our local regulatory environment that, if they are changed, will create a more enabling environment. The fund and the policy agenda are predicated on the pipeline that we talked about in our last meeting. And really what the pipeline allows us to do is to use resources more optimally so that we can leverage resources. Because very often what happens is folks sort of have like their hands over their head when they're planning for a project or development. And then because we can't really see everything and there's usually not a high degree of trust, then what happens is resources are used suboptimally and don't actually really drive the pipeline. I think I'm going to pause here and I want to ask Conrado if there's any questions at this point, but I want to ask if Mike or Nancy could jump in maybe talk about the functionality of the fund from here and how it leverages and creates a permanent vehicle. But Conrado, I'll pause first. Are there questions before we keep going?
Thank you, Heather. I will pass it to our committee chair, Yvette Perez-Gil. She has questions.
She's on mute.
I don't have any questions, but does anyone else have any questions?
I'll save mine for the end. I wasn't there on the 5th of November.
Oh, so I'm sorry, Director Borja, I thought you were.
No, it's all right. Taking it in. I read the notes, but they were
okay. Short, yeah.
On our end.
Nancy, could I pass to you from here and then to Mike, and then I could wrap up at the end?
Sure. I think I saw Carol had her hand up, so I don't want to cut her off. No? Okay.
And if you want me to go forward or back, just tell me, because I'm
okay
on the deck.
Yeah, we're doing virtual slide presentations, which is exciting. So yeah, Heather, why don't you move back to back up there to the pipe? Nope, one down, please, to the pipeline. So one of the most important things that we have to do in order to figure out how to create a fund that's actually going to work in the Coachella Valley is we have to get an estimate of what the demand is for capital. Who is developing projects that don't have enough capital, that can't find gap capital for their projects, and what kind of capital, what is the shape of the capital, what is the term of the capital, what's the risk of the capital that the projects need. And so we began to analyze that by creating a pipeline. And that was a community process. And that I made this point before, but it's really important that the entire community sat around the table. Every developer in the Valley contributed projects to this pipeline in the hopes that they would be able, if we succeed in creating this, that they would have a resource that would enable their projects to go forward. So all told, we identified over 40 projects representing about $700 million of economic investment in Coachella Valley. That also represents about almost 3,000 units. And the capital gaps within those projects are about $200 million. So that convinced us that there was enough demand in the Valley that it made sense for us to design a capital fund. You can go down, I think, to the next one, Heather. Or Araceli, yep, great. It's important to us as we think about designing this fund to also build in features of social equity. So we could easily build a capital fund and then just do the easiest projects that are available to be done, but that's not the goal of this effort. The goal of this effort is to activate projects that couldn't be done otherwise, make it possible to get them done, but also to keep an eye on the issue of equity. So for example, if at the end of 10 years, we look back and we saw that all of the housing that had been created through this fund was all located in one place within the Valley, that would not be what we think of as being equitable and advancing the issues and the concern of fairness and equitable development. So we're bringing that mission lens along with the investment lens to what we're doing. We've already identified the first four projects that would get done. These projects in total need about $5 million of investment. I'm gonna let Mike talk about some of the specifics of the projects, but I think this is, you all may or may not remember my background. I was the CEO of a community development finance organization for 20 years. We did many, many funds. I will tell you that this fund has one of the best starts that I've ever seen. And with these many projects ready to go in need of our capital, this fund is gonna succeed. So I'm pretty excited about it, and I'm excited about this first group of projects that will receive investment.
Karen has a question.
Nancy, by partners on this slide, do you mean developer, like the person who's constructing these or building?
Mike may address this a little better than I will, but for example, RCAC is the Rural Community Assistance Corporation. That is a community development finance organization. So they're providing financing into this, and Riverside County is the other entity in some of these projects. I'm looking at the first one, the Polanco Parks one, and Riverside County in that project would also be providing subsidy and support. Mike, do you want to say more about who the partners are and the different projects?
I guess what the information I'm looking for is who collects the rent, who collects the mortgage at the end of this unit being built.
I see. So who is the, in other words, who is the owner of the property?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mike, I think that's in your bailiwick.
Yeah. So these are just four sample projects. And I think You can stay where, stop there. These are four sample projects. So for example, one thing that we were looking at crafting and working with RCAC on is something specific for the Polanco Park community. So the majority of Polanco Park owners are not able to access traditional capital. So even if they were to want to go forward and to redo their park, they can't go to Wells Fargo, Bank of America, or other sort of lenders in order to access that type of capital to make it work out well. So what we, through this fund, are working with RCAC on is where RCAC would, Rural Communities Assistance Corporation, they would provide a loan to, in this example, like Jose Perez, or in Jose Perez, is that case, like he's also, multiple family members are also owners of the park. We would provide the loan capital to them to rebuild the park, redo it. And then ultimately the loan will be paid off by Clearinghouse CDFI, another entity of an intermediary. And then Jose Perez would be working with the families to collect the rent from each of the parks. All of, in this instance, like where all the rents would be meet the definitions of affordability, but they would, the individual park owners would be the ones collecting the rents going forward. The other examples here, the Ivy Palm Hotel, Indian Wells Apartments and Thermal Apartments, there'll be some other developers such as maybe CVHC or Abode Communities or Jamboree or other developers who would be the ultimate ones who would be the owner of the apartment communities. So Ivy Palm Hotel, this is a potential acquisition that the County of Riverside is working through that secured an allocation of home key funding to move forward with. The apartment complex or the hotel is currently in bankruptcy. And so we at the county are working through the process with the bankruptcy court to try and get the approval on the sale. We'll know more in the next week or so whether that'll be approved, but this would be the conversion of a 100 unit hotel and the 81 units of permanent supportive housing. The way the fund really comes into play here is that it's somewhat like complicated. Like, so you're getting $8.5 million or whatever to acquire the property. Like, is that enough to make it work? It's like, well, that's enough to acquire it. But then there's all of the expenses. You have to hire an architect, an engineer, attorneys, fees to the city, other expenses that get you to a place where you can apply for the ultimate funding to make it completed. And so when that money comes in, that would allow a developer to come in and pay for all of those other expenses in order to they get in the position to obtain the lion's share of the money needed to make the project work. And I'm not sure if there's specific questions on any of the projects or how it would come in, but I'm here to answer any of those questions as well.
Thank you, Mike Walsh. Nancy, do you wanna do the capital stack?
Sure, happy to do that. Okay. I thought there was a question about homeownership. So if we wanna address that now, Heather, we can, or we can move on through the capital stack.
Why don't we move through the capital stack and then I can talk a little bit about the units that are in the pipeline and more broadly where homeownership fits into that.
You bet. Right. So whenever you're doing...
Sorry, I don't know what I'm doing. Okay.
you create a capital fund that's of the scale that's contemplated here, which is $100 to $150 million, that's about where we estimate the demand is going to leave us. This kind of fund can't be done by any single entity. It takes multiple investors and multiple partners to pull something of this scale together. And that requires you to think about the needs and the role of different investors. So for example, at the very top of, we think of this as a layer cake, and each of the layers has a nice color from the rainbow. If you look at the very top of this layer cake, you see private capital. So that would be capital that would be invested from partners like Morgan Stanley or Bank of America that have private requirements. They have requirements for risk, they have requirements for earnings, they have requirements for where they can be and what types of projects they can do. Below that, you see that we expect community development financial organizations will also invest their own capital into this. They have their own requirements. They're a little bit less demanding than the private sector. And so we think of them as being sort of in the middle of this layer cake. And then at the very bottom of the layer cake is what we call the risk absorbing capital. It's like the shock absorber for the fund. And it's able to tolerate if things go wrong, it gives us some risk cushion that enables us to defray capital risk that is taken on by other partners. So the magic of doing one of these funds is that you figure out what each type of investor needs and you work around those needs. And then you are able to then blend the capital from different sources together to create an entire cake. So the cake has different layers to it, but at the end of the day, it's a single cake. And so when funds, loans, grants go out to the community, they come from a single source with a single, they look like the same loan, not four or five different pieces to the same loan. And that's really the magic or the alchemy that goes into making these funds work. But when we blend all of that capital together, we're able to do a number of really creative things. For example, some lenders will have very short terms. Some investors in the fund will have a much lower risk tolerance than others. We're able to accommodate all of that, and we're able to match the needs that they have and still provide capital that is both favorable, that is risk absorbing, and that is very well priced to our community. And so that's the purpose of creating what we call the capital stack. And that's what makes this entire project go forward. What we're expecting that the fund will do is provide a combination of many, many different types of loans. For example, pre-development and early stage site acquisition loans. This is something that would not be provided by banks or by other private sector partners. So we're expecting the fund would step in with that level of capital, which is sometimes the greatest need. Permanent financing, we expect that we'll be able to develop some amount of what we call mini permanent loans, which are loans that have a 7-year term, but they're amortized over a longer period of time. So we're expecting that we'll be able to offer a variety of financing types to the community. And by doing that, we should be able to be flexible enough to, and nimble enough to be responsive to the full range of community need. Go on to the next slide. So how will the fund work? We know that we need expertise. Putting these capital funds together and making them work is a profession unto itself. The Low Income Investment Fund, which is a 35-year-old community development financial institution, I used to be the CEO of that organization, is very, very skilled in doing this work. We've already talked about the Rural Community Assistance Corporation. They also are about a 40-year-old organization and have done similar work to that of LIF. But the Low Income Investment Fund has been chosen to be the fund manager. LIF has, as I said, 35 years of experience working at the national level. LIF is active in about 30 states across the US. Its headquarters is in California, and it has deployed over $2 billion of capital over the history of the organization. That capital in turn has leveraged another $8 billion in capital. So altogether, LIF has been responsible for deploying about $10 billion into low-income communities across the US, housing being the core part of its work. And that matches perfectly with what our need is in Coachella Valley and with the Catalyst Fund. So we've designated LIF as the fund manager. Rural Community Assistance Corporation will be a partner working in the rural parts of the Coachella Valley. And if you could move back, Araceli or Heather, one slide, how the fund will work. We also understand, and this is a really important point, a fund in and of itself is not enough to get the job done. The fund has to be matched with other resources outside of these loans coming from the fund for specific uses. So for example, the county has already pledged housing vouchers, which provide operating subsidies for the homes that will be developed through this fund. Cities within the Coachella Valley have offered up their remaining rural development association or Rural Development Agency capital grants, and LIF and RCAC will both provide their own capital, putting their own balance sheets at risk. So that's, as I said earlier, that's, we're getting funds from many different sources. We're going to bring them all together to the table. And by synchronizing this, we're able to get something that's greater than the sum of the parts. Now move down, please, to one slide. I described LIF. One more.
Can you repeat for me what the cities have agreed to so far, or some cities have agreed to so far?
Sure. So some of the cities in Coachella Valley, and I think Heather will be able to give us the detail on that, have funds remaining either from the rural RDA, from the rural development agents, the redevelopment agencies that were established in California many years ago. Those agencies have been deactivated, but many cities still have funds that haven't been deployed remaining from those grants. In addition, there are other state pipelines of grant funds that are available to come into the valley for housing support. And so we know and are working closely with the cities to marshal those funds to make them available to support the developments in this initiative. Do you want to amplify on that, Heather, at all?
Yeah, sure. So one thing to say is that almost all of the cities, except two, but it's just administrative, have provided official letters of support for the fund, which is essentially a commitment to coordinate with the fund. And Director Borja, back on this slide, it used to be a three-legged stool, but that was hard for people to understand. If you look here at the yellow, red, and the purple dots, the circle in the middle is the capital fund. And the idea, like Nancy said, is what we did with the pipeline is scrubbed it down with developers and community orgs and residents to say, like, what are that list of products on the cake page? Here, where's the cake? Here on the left, the product types, that's based on what people said they need for their projects to be able to move. And so one of the things you see in the first batch is I think almost all of them are pre-development capital, except the Jose Perez Polanco Park, which is a specific type of Polanco lending. But ultimately, these three things have to act in cooperation with each other for the pipeline to move. And that's the really awesome thing about the fund, is that it creates an incentive to coordinate and leverage all of our resources. And that's kind of where the cake analogy came from, is instead of like folks fighting for crumbs and going project by project, this gives us a way to catalyze. Because a lot of times, like for instance, there's money in the state budget for early childhood or healthcare infrastructure. But a lot of times the reason why it's not integrated into a development is because our local folks don't have the resources for the planning and pre-development dollars to get a consultant to plan for and then seek those state funds. So that's the way that the fund really operates to catalyze. And so the role of the city, the cities and the county and the state in some ways is for us to be effectively coordinated together to make the units move. I don't know if Mike, you
can add anything. Yeah, I'd like to just add something quickly. In doing funds like this, you almost never see this level of coordination. So what is, I think, really, really special about what's happening in Coachella Valley is that many of the necessary partners have gotten together in advance. Normally, when you do a fund like this, the community development financial institution is just simply raising the capital and hoping that when the capital goes out the door, the developer is able to pull all the different pieces together that will make the project work. But what we've been doing is getting everyone together in advance and primed and ready to support these projects as soon as possible. And so what that means is we're actually changing the way the system in Coachella Valley is operating and making it more synchronous and making it more harmonized. And our belief is that will unlock a lot of the potential for developing affordable housing in the Valley.
Karen, I'm sorry, Director Borja, did that help, or you have more questions?
Yes, and this may be the best place for me to insert my first bigger question, which is about the housing element. When I was working out in the Oasis community, Mountain View Estates had just sort of like started wrapping up. People had started moving in. The county did not have its housing element up to date and had not passed its housing element. So we were not able to apply for state funding for the park a couple miles away from Mountain View Estates. That would have helped with the low-income units that were being built, would have helped with the park money that we needed a couple miles away. So my first question is, what kind of housing element advocacy will you all be doing in part as part of this project that you have going on, or is it not part of this project? And that might be more of like a mic question, I'm not sure.
I don't mind jumping in. One thing, Director Borja, I would say the county at long last does have an up-to-date housing element, so that's one good piece. But I think the key where this larger pipeline as it looks like is that it's not just a housing or a finance mechanism. The work that's really being done here is to marry the finance pieces with the housing element work. Because along those similar sort of lines, many jurisdictions in the Coachella Valley lack the proper density, where density be warranted to really compete for funding from the state for cap and trade financing or other things. So it's almost like we self-disqualify. So part of like the work that needs to be done and is being done through Lift to Rise, and I don't want to step on too much of their toes, but the work that we've been working in conjunction with the Lift to Rise on is like, how do we get both of them looking together that we have an inventory of projects that this project would move, but for what? It's maybe not always a financing option. The financing may come from somewhere else, but it could be, how do we get the city to update their zoning code for this to make sure that the housing element is slotting sites appropriately, and also doing the necessary advocacy at the state level to provide the level of flexibility for local jurisdictions to make these, approve these projects more easily. So it's the policy work is part and parcel to the housing fund work.
Arceli has a comment, but as everyone now knows on the phone, we're tech boomers, so I'm not sure if you're gonna be able to hear her, but she's gonna try.
I will be very loud and brief, hopefully you can hear me. Yeah, everything that Mike said, 100%. I just wanted to add that we are actively working with the cities through both planning, policy, and really understanding the needs at each city. Many of you know we have a regional affordable housing planner in role here at Live to Rise. That is a shared position between the county and Live to Rise. And her role, her name's Taylor, in her role, she works with all the cities because as we know, the housing element is just planning for housing needs. And so the question that we hold is how are we actually gonna get to meeting those needs? And part of that is what Mike was saying, thinking about the policy and the planning activities that need to happen to actually get those units built. So in Taylor's role, she works with cities to really understand what planning grants are available at the state level that then could translate into planning activities locally. But really it's about the coordination that happens among the municipalities to try and understand what policy solutions are needed to make a more enabling environment. So just wanted to chime in there because that's work that we're actively doing. Thank you.
And just wanted to add that this is a strategy of our action plan. So this was like 50 partners together a year and a half ago got together and said, okay, what's it gonna take across the next 2 years to move 2000 units? And that's, and part of that plan was to continue to inventory the pipeline and aggregate the units to build an investment vehicle to define a regional planning role and hire that. So this is part of a plan. It's not like a one-off. And Director Borja, your comments on the housing element, especially the plan is iterative. So the things that we're missing or where there might be blind spots, although that is a place we're working, we continue to build on, but just want to underscore the importance of this being part and parcel of a multi-path plan. I'm not sure if there's other questions. I had one other thing I wanted to add, but I'll wait for questions.
Heather, could I jump in with a point?
Sure.
If it's okay, I will. I think one of the nice outcomes that we'll see once this fund gets going is that Coachella Valley will be more successful in advocating for state and national resources because the fund is bringing partners, developers, community groups together to create a vision for the valley, as opposed to what's been happening up until now is each nonprofit developer has competed on their own for state or other resources. But what we are being able to do by bringing these groups together is actually speak with a single voice, have a vision for the valley, and then drive more resources into Coachella Valley. So Director Borja, I thought that was a really good point that you raised because it allowed us to get into some of these nice features that the fund is gonna be providing.
Does anyone have questions for Heather and everyone else?
This is Carol.
Hey, Carol.
Hi there. So going forward, how do you see the role of the district playing in helping to establish the fund?
I think that we think a really powerful investment from the district would be a recoverable grant that would allow us to move the pipeline forward. Recoverable grants happen a lot with funds like this, but a significant recoverable grant would allow us to braid capital, blend down the rate of capital, make projects move. And then that way, the funds would be returned to the district in 10 years. I know the district has made a lot of capital or some big capital investments recently and has to be really mindful of its financial position. But I think that paves a pathway for the district to do something really catalytic and powerful, and is also mindful of the district's position.
So a recoverable grant would be some kind of a contractual loan to Live to Rise, or to what organization?
Yeah, it would actually be a grant. It would be a grant to Live to Rise. All of the funding awards for the fund are made to Live to Rise, and then they are, the low-income investment fund acts essentially as the manager or the fiscal agent of the funds, and obviously has, as Nancy explained, really high credibility to do that. I don't know, Carol, does that fully answer the question, or Mike or Nancy, if I missed a piece?
Yeah, so the idea of a recoverable grant is normally when you give a grant, it goes out, it doesn't come back. The idea of the recoverable grant is you make the grant, we're asking for 10 years, which is unusual. Grants are usually made on an annual basis, or maybe they'll have a 3-year term, but you never see it again. We're asking for 10 years because we want to deploy that grant into loans, which will be repaid, and then we will return it at the end of the 10-year period. So it's really kind of the gift that keeps on giving, if you will, because it will be highly leveraged. I mean, a $10 million recoverable grant would help us raise $100 million, and it will recycle probably 3 times within that 10-year period.
So, and because it's a recoverable grant, it would show up as a asset/liability on our balance sheet and not as an expense.
Correct. It depends on how you want to record it, but it would probably, I have a little bit of an accounting background. It would show up as an asset on your balance sheet.
Okay. And what is staff recommendation for this project?
I still have a few other questions.
Okay, keep going there, Karen.
I have major concerns about how our cities across the valley are handling development at the moment. I attended a couple of different things, the Coachella Valley Economic Partnership Summit, the All Mayors Breakfast, and a realtor's like random summit. A realtor's interview expose that they did over the summer. And all of these three groups were talking about COVID, the effect of COVID on the housing market across the Coachella Valley. All of them have said the planning department in the cities is booming. They are building now more than they ever have. The realtor said that they are selling at 15% higher than any other summer since the recession. And so I attended the Indio City Council last week. There was 2 things that happened. One, the city voted, the council voted to put in apartment complexes, but one of our council members, Elaine Holmes, the mayor, said it wasn't, like the density was too much. She wanted less density for homes in like acreage. So the way people in our valley are thinking about housing is more land, less people on that land. The way people are thinking about density across the valley is genuinely not gonna help with what I think you're all proposing here, what our RENA numbers are. And to be honest, the situation across the valley of overcrowdedness, a very large amount of people being unhoused and unsheltered, and people who are having to stay at home, come back from college, into our communities because of COVID and whatever comes after COVID. Mm-hmm. So my concern is, as I see your four projects and I look at the Indian Wells apartment complex that you're planning, the question that I posed to you all is the same question one of our council members posed to the developer in Indio: will these be empty units for Airbnb? What is the guarantee that if we give you all X amount of money, like, we are not perpetrating to the developers and the harm and causes that they're bringing to the valley, right? The CVEP CEO spoke about all of this housing that is coming in for people from San Francisco and Seattle. And he only spoke about the Coachella Valley as a workforce meant to serve people who are coming from outside of the area, buying homes here, which are cheaper. So I have a lot of concerns just regarding the market period, regarding how our cities are planning, how our cities are going to be looking at the housing elements as they continue to develop them. I know my city is in the process of like hiring a consultant and starting to do housing element work. I just genuinely don't know how, I don't think your answer to my question about the housing element was sufficient enough to my concerns about the way CVEP, our mayors, and our realtors are talking about housing in the Coachella Valley and are selling and building housing at the moment in the Coachella Valley.
Sure, I'll start there. And Director Borja, just to say, like, we 100% concur with everything that you're saying. So the first thing to say is that capital or money, like water, flows downhill to the things that are easiest to fund. And the fund is designed to create a systems shift and to re-engineer the way that capital is flowing so that it's flowing uphill to the things that are community priorities that are much more difficult to fund and that require this type of direct and intentional intervention. And Mike can speak specifically to the affordability aspect. Everything, 100% of the units that are in the pipeline and that the fund will support are affordable and have affordability covenants. So there's nothing that the pipeline is supporting. So the pipeline in general, the housing can, the partners, they have three priorities over these first 2 years of the action plan supporting this. One is regional equity. So advancing units that aren't on the backside of the moon, that have proximity to institutional infrastructure. Two is rent burden. And so this gets at your question, is only advancing projects that are going to actually solve for rent burden. So we're targeting 80% of AMI and below. And the third is readiness. So advanced planning is essentially what we're trying to do here. But in order to draw down and absorb investment, we have to have projects that are ready to move. But I'll pause, and I think Mike is going to jump in, but I want to get back to addressing your housing element concern to say, like, the fund is designed and our broader agenda is specifically about addressing the concerns that you just brought up.
I just provide some context of what assurity that the district or anyone else would have in terms of how these projects, if they actually are affordable. What we would more than likely look to is that within the agreement, the grant agreement, the loan agreement between the Lift to Rise and the district, you would put in necessary covenants that these only funds could be used for X, Y, and Z. Those covenants would then be passed on to a developer who would then would be recorded against the property, so that the property would only be able to use for those purposes. If they were found in violation, they would be out of default on the loan and then the next right proceedings. One thing I want to really highlight about Indian Wells is the Indian Wells property is 100% only can be done for affordable housing purposes. And because it's tied with redevelopment agency rules and there's regulatory agreements attached to it. The projects that are in the pipeline all have, with the one caveat there, I would say the Polanco's, it's a separate subset that do not oftentimes will not come with these covenants, but everything else will come with long-term affordability covenants that are either from the state of California, the county, the federal government, or the state government to ensure the long-term affordability. Right now, the majority of housing projects that are being developed in the Coachella Valley are largely market rate, but I would say right now we're seeing more affordable housing projects that are moving forward in the desert than we have over the last 5 years. We're the Coachella Valley Housing Coalition is breaking ground on 100 units in the city of Indio within the next three weeks for replacement housing. There'll be starting construction on housing for homeless veterans in Cathedral City in early March. And then the county and Lift to Rise and others are working with the city on Palm Springs on three other affordable housing projects that are expected to break ground over the next period of time. It's like, this isn't the sort of the, there needs to be more because of all the reasons that we've previously discussed and people know about, but it's, the security that the district has is what would be into your ultimate loan agreements that would be passed on to the Lift to Rise and then in turn to the developers.
Mike or Heather, can you put a range onto what is actually deemed affordable?
So affordable is anything 80% of area median income and below. So in terms of like a rent for a family of four, that's probably somewhere around, I'm just trying to make my screen smaller so I can pull it up, but all right. Probably, give me 2 seconds. I'll pull it up. I apologize for this. I should know this information off the top of my head. For a family of four, that is rents that are $1,567 a month or below. But the majority, I would say, if we're looking at the income brackets across our county, the majority of affordable housing that's being built is really tailored to people that earn 60% of area median income below, which again, for a family of four on a would be rents of $1,175 or below. But the majority of housing projects that are being incentivized now actually are incentivized to have deeper affordability. The nonprofit developer Chalk is working on a project in Palm Springs where the average affordability is 30% of area median income and below, which is extremely low incomes. And we're seeing that on projects throughout the valley. The project that's being built by CVHC in Indio is specifically for farm workers, and all of the units have rental assistance. So families only need to pay 30% of their income for towards rent. So even if they only earned $500 a month, they would still only be paying 30% of their income on for that unit.
And is that measured every year then? I mean, are they valued every year? So like, it's not like rent control. I mean, you know, you get into a place and you can stay there forever at a particular rent, or is it something that could fluctuate almost an arm, you know, you earn more, you can pay more?
There are long-term affordability restrictions, and there's maximum caps on that are much more aggressive than what state law is on what you can increase from, increase rent year over year. And so I forget the exact percentage, but it's less than 6%. I think it's like really like 3%. You can increase your rent year to year on your rents. So if you're in that unit, you're more or less, you're in a rent control situation for your time there.
Thanks.
I was just going to add that one thing that's really important about the fund is we don't actually have a CDFI, a community development financial institution, on the ground in the valley. And one of the things to shift the challenges that you were talking about, Director Borja, is we need to incentivize more nonprofit developers and more actors to the region in order to get to the scale that we need to get to solve for our severe deficit of housing. We need to support our existing actors and great folks like the Coachella Valley Housing Coalition through the fund, and we need to incentivize more affordable housing development and nonprofit developers to the region. But folks haven't had a mechanism to make their projects be able to pencil out, and the fund catalyzes and allows for folks to be able to do that. So I think investment really begets investment. But one other thing I just wanted to flag before I forget is that There's 33,000 rent-burdened households in the Coachella Valley, the average household size of four. We're talking about a quarter of our year-round population, more than 120,000 people that are rent-burdened. And there's an issue that comes up quite frequently, and our answer to this is always yes, which is like, why are you targeting rent burden and what about home ownership? And these things aren't mutually exclusive. I'll send over a slide that, I'm sorry, it's not in the deck, but we have a breakdown of the units in the pipeline, which does include some home ownership. But what we're trying to solve for is how do we get to scale quickly and how do we iterate and add? And so with, one could easily argue that to get to scale, that the hugest impacted population are renters, and we have a crisis deficit of supply. And absolutely, we need to target home ownership. But all of these things, I think, are they run concurrently, not necessarily against each other. But I just wanted to flag that because I know that's a question that comes up for folks. We absolutely agree with and affirm that building equity and building assets is incredibly important. And simultaneously, we have a humongous population of folks that we're just trying to keep from falling into homelessness. We need units, period. So there's multiple vehicles that are needed. This is a really strong and powerful vehicle. We've raised over $1 million to be able to support the operations of it for the first 3 years. We'll have a CDFI on the ground here in the Coachella Valley. The Low Income Investment Fund is hiring a fund manager. And also this took a few years and probably more than seven figures of resources to get at this solution. So just wanted to flag there's so many intersectional complications, but this really provides a vehicle for us to build and iterate and add and address a lot of the other concerns that we have that intersect with housing instability, including health infrastructure and advanced planning for the built environment and all kinds of things like that. Wanted to throw that in there.
Okay. Does anyone else have any more questions?
I do. So from a financial perspective, you say that the funds are 100% recoverable. Is that correct?
Yes.
But the reason I ask or question that is that the recovery of the grant proceeds, the language that's in there, it says that any proceeds that have not been deployed into project loans or grants, or any proceeds that have been repaid from project loans and were not allocated to cover project losses, will be returned to the Desert Healthcare District. Nowhere does it say that there's a guarantee that these monies will be recovered by the healthcare district. So I'm wondering how those add up.
Sure, I can start. I don't know if Mike, if you want to start.
I guess I would really defer to like Heather, because you guys are going to be the ones that have, they're going to be making the ultimate guarantee like on those sort of things. But I think in general, Chris, I think the question really comes down to the what could be included there as the sort of security can be whatever the district would want to see in terms of what language would need to be placed in there to make the district feel comfortable enough to make an investment if that was the option. I almost, when these sort of things, when we talk with county council is, tell me what we need to do to make it work or find a way to make a solution if this is something that the larger board wants to make a decision on.
Yeah, and I think Chris, I'll just add, because we haven't actually written a proposal yet. I think there's like multiple pathways to do this. And I think the one that we're landing on that seems like the most plausible is a recoverable grant. And I'm not exactly sure if it was something that we had written in something before. There's another large funder where it's a similar to a recoverable grant, but it's a PRI because it's a foundation that does PRIs. And the agreement is to return what's there. So I'm not sure if that was the language, but it's our intention, if we are invited to write the proposal, to ask for a 100% recoverable grant.
Okay, because that language that I read was in the template information that you sent for us to use for the FNA packet. So I didn't know if that was exactly what's gonna be included or not. And I also then referenced to, because you had sent to us for legal counsel's review a recoverable grant agreement between the Metropolitan Transportation Commission and the Low Income Investment Fund. And in that, it also says the same thing, and it's concerning because that says that the monies that are repaid to the Metropolitan Transportation Commission is also subordinate to any of the main loans that are considered senior in loans that need to be repaid before this recoverable grant is paid. So, you know, so with so many financing mechanisms or components to this project, I'm just concerned that the recoverable grant becomes secondary to all of these other primary loans and could be, you know, it's unsecured, it seems to me, and very subject to possibly not being refunded. So that's my concern from a financial perspective.
I'll jump in because the recoverable grant from the Metropolitan Transportation Commission was to my former organization, the Low Income Investment Fund. This was seed capital that they provided that absolutely made it possible to pull the fund together. And part of what was needed was some certainty that that the investors would have a cushion against risk. So frequently, recoverable grants are set up as essentially as grants that then have the possibility of being recovered. But you can set, you have the liberty to, there's nothing that's cast in cement. You have the liberty to structure this as you wish. So I think, you know, I think I'll just leave it at that and say that those are the kinds of things that generally we would try to get into a little bit later. You know, if this is something you want to proceed with, we would get into how to make it possible to make it go forward.
Yes. And I also want to say that that is a conversation for the Finance and Legal and Administration Committee. We will have a meeting later today. I believe that what we're trying to get at through the program committee is the value of this program and give the opportunity to the members of this committee to ask questions about the mechanics, the logistics, who is going to benefit, how are we going to ensure that ultimately this is going to have a health impact or a benefit impact on the wellness of our communities and have some meaningful programmatic questions answered in through this process before we made the decision or of making a recommendation on the Finance Committee.
But part of the reason I say this or bring it to attention for the program committee is that I think it needs to be considered unless it can be more surety coming from the Finance Committee is that to me it looks like the program committee would need to be considering this as a grant to give away potentially and may not be recoverable. If there's some ways of shoring that up, then from the Finance Committee side, I think that works. I just thought it was beneficial to the program committee.
I don't know if it's gonna be helpful to you to know this, but in the 35 years that the Low Income Investment Fund has been making loans, the loss rate is less than 1%. Now, Coachella Valley is a little bit different. The risk in Coachella Valley is a little bit higher, but a 1% loss rate is generally regarded as an A-plus performance. And the mission, I mean, the social impact of what's being accomplished is extraordinary. I mean, what you're able to leverage by being in a by stimulating this, by catalyzing and seeding this is so much greater than the dollars that are going in. The social impact is huge.
Yeah, I think, Chris, we hear you on this. And I think, like Mike said, that we can address this. And Nancy said this also, that we'll take an example, the California Endowment, for example, often writes in on PRIs, like they are extended at the end of a term, or there's a level of forgiveness on risk. Like all those things can be addressed, but I think that we can also talk about this in the finance committee is one, the low income investment funds track record, but really the security that happens by way of there being multiple investors. Lift to Rise certainly isn't doing everything we can so that the fund operates and functions in a phenomenally functional and I think in safe way. And the low income investment fund is, and not just saying this because Nancy's on the phone, because it wasn't inevitable that they were going to actually manage the fund. They're probably the best CDFI we could get to be able to take on this complicated work.
Okay. Does anybody else have any more questions? Hearing none, we'll move on to grant funding requests.
Thank you, everyone. Heather. We're going to see you in a couple hours.
Thank you, Heather.
So we have number one under funding request, Voices for Children, consideration to approve grant number 1149 for $40,000 for the court appointed special advocates program. Who will be discussing this?
So Voices for Children is a very successful and nonprofit organization that they've come to us before in the past for court-appointed special advocates. Even more now, these advocates are needed for children, foster children, and this grant will pay for foster advocates for 2,000 foster kids in the Coachella Valley. Jessica Munoz, who's the executive director, has joined us in the meeting if anybody has any questions for her.
Does anyone have any questions for Jessica?
This is Carol.
Yes, Carol.
I just wanted to know if there's any, because we funded this wonderful program in the past, has there been any changes, any improvements, new recommendations that we should be aware of?
Jessica, did you want to add something, or do you want me to take this?
Sure. I wasn't sure if that was a question for me or you.
Can you speak up? We can hardly hear you.
Let's see. Is that better?
Does that help?
Now you can. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Donna. I wasn't sure if that was a question for you or me, but I'm happy to.
I didn't either.
I'm happy to address it. And then if there is something that you think would be helpful for the directors, I'd be grateful for you to add your comments as well. To answer the question directly, really what we're aiming to do is to grow our program in a way that's programmatically sustainable and fiscally responsible. So the requests that we have will help us serve additional children in the Coachella Valley that have not received service so far. And the funding that we received in the last cycle was incredibly impactful, but we continue to have children who need our service. In terms of sort of new strategies that we've implemented, of course, like everyone, COVID has required that we think very creatively and flexibly about how we ensure that we're continuing to provide advocacy for children. So we have shifted our volunteer training to a virtual format that has been very successful. We've completed 8 sessions of pre-service training in that format, which has allowed us to continue to serve additional children.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Does anyone else have any more questions? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the grant?
A motion to approve the GASA grant.
I second.
All those in favor? Okay, right?
Aye. Aye.
The motion passes to the board for approval. We will move on to committee member comments. Is there any committee member comments at this moment?
This is Carol. I have a comment.
Okay, Carol.
At our last board meeting, the staff indicated that they would have community members that were specific to grants and programs that we were discussing to substitute for appointed community members. And I noticed that we didn't have any other community members other than directors present. And I'm just wondering what the plan was for that ongoing.
Hi, Director Rogers. I think there might be some misunderstanding. At the board meeting, the decision was to pass or to approve a new policies, OP3, that eliminates the participation of appointed members of the public in committees. So that's what was approved, and that's the premise for today's meeting. We don't have appointed public members of the public participating in today's meeting. What we did say is that we do encourage public participation, and we have a policy that outlines how that participation happens, and also that staff will reach out to community members and experts when appropriate, when necessary, to review grants, to provide input, to provide feedback in the grant making process or financial process, any process that requires input from the public. And we will give you an example on how the staff has done this when we move on to the foundation part of this meeting, and we will explain to you how the public participated in providing that feedback to us.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Corrado, for explaining that again. Any more committee member comments? Hearing none, we'll adjourn this meeting and go directly into the foundation. We'll adjourn this meeting at 1:23 and move directly into the foundation meeting. Okay, I'll call the meeting to order at 1:23. Is there approval to... Is there a motion to approve the agenda?
I motion to approve.
Second.
Okay. Is there a motion to approve the meeting minutes?
I motion to approve the minutes.
Second.
Okay, so we'll move on to public comments. At this time, comments from the audience may be made on items not listed on the agenda that are for public that are of public interest and within the subject matter jurisdiction of the district. The committee has a policy of limiting speakers to not more than 3 minutes. The committee cannot take action on items not listed on the agenda. Public input may be offered on an agenda item when it comes up for discussion and or action. Are there any public comments at this moment? Hearing none, I'll move on to new business, United Way of the Desert Equity Fund. Who will be providing information?
That's me. Unfortunately, I haven't received any new information about the Desert Equity Fund. This is a conversation that I had with Cristo Granados at United Way of the Desert prior to the last board meeting, so I informed the board about this conversation. I believe that there is an impetus on behalf of various foundations in the Inland Empire to create a collaborative fund to address the needs of, I believe, Black folks primarily. And addressing the needs of Black communities is something that we have prioritized here at the National Health System Foundation. So I announced at the last board meeting that we had an initial conversation, but I haven't heard anything new from Crystal or from anybody else within the funding community of the Inland Empire. The conversation we had at the time was related to the needs of Black communities go beyond access to healthcare, and we understand that. And if there will be an equity fund that it's designed to address those needs outside of healthcare, we want to collaborate and see how we from the Desert Healthcare District and Foundation can support that type of work. In the meantime, we will continue to maintain our efforts to address their access to healthcare.
Thank you. Thank you. Does anyone have questions for Conrado? Hearing none, we'll move on to old business, Coachella Valley Equity Collaborative.
Thank you. The Coachella Valley Equity Collaborative has been doing a tremendous job, particularly in Eastern Coachella Valley. Last weekend, we had a very large couple of events, and I will invite Alejandro, who is leading that effort with the different organizations, to provide an overview of what we have done. And after Alejandro provides that verbal report, I will talk to you about the Public Health Institute. Thank you, Alejandro, please.
Yeah, thank you, Conrado. As Conrado mentioned, we've had tremendous success in providing educational materials and scheduling screening events in the eastern part of the Coachella Valley. This weekend, we had two events, one scheduled on Saturday at Our Lady of Soledad in Coachella and Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mecca on Sunday. At the testing event in Coachella, we tested 143 community members, which was amazing. The county rolled out a new testing RV, or trailer, I should say, that it has three examination rooms, and we utilized the new curative test that is being used at the Rancho Mirage Library, which is a self-administered test. It's a mouth swab, it's no longer the nasal swab, which a lot of our community members were very, very happy about. So they no longer have to get their brain tickled when they get tested anymore. So that was a huge success. And I think, the coordination of all the different community-based organizations and also the support of the supervisor's office, had made this, these events really successful. In Mecca, in Mecca, we actually had, four masses starting very early at 7 a.m. We were there with the trailer once again. We were doing on-site registration, and that's something that we have heard from feedback from some of our promotoras and our community-based organization partners, is that folks actually like the fact that they don't have to schedule an appointment. They like just showing up to the event, doing the on-site registration. And that's something that we have implemented at these two events with great success. We use QR codes to do the registration. For folks that are not tech savvy, we do have promotoras that were trained on how to do the registration. But then we also have a really interesting phenomenon where young adults that are there with their, with their parents, grandparents, actually help them, utilize the QR code and do the registration on their phone. Once they receive a confirmation number, they just get in line to do the test itself. So in Mecca, we were given 10 minutes after each mass, because they're the only church that is actually doing outdoor mass still. And we were able to give you know, pretty much a 10-minute presentation on the test itself and the need for the test. There we tested 255 individuals within a 4-hour time span. So we have become really efficient at rolling out these tests. We do have some upcoming events next week. We're actually going to have 2 weekday events at the same locations, and we're going to go back on Saturday and Sunday at the same locations to continue the testing. So, you know, also we are working on some educational materials that Will, our Director of Communications, has created a subcommittee with some of our community partners to kind of, you know, develop these educational materials, outreach materials in different languages. We will have them available in English, Spanish, and Purapecha. Some of our community partners are, you know, taping some PSAs in English, Spanish, and Purapecha that would be disseminated through, you know, social media platforms, websites, Facebook Live, etc. So right now, and we also have, you know, a group of community health workers, promotoras, that are out there, you know, within the community, knocking on doors, you know, going to places like shopping centers, you know, to disseminate the information and also provide PPE and, you know, let people know when we have these testing events. So great work that is being done. We're also making a lot of headway in, you know, bringing on, you know, some of the growers to do on-site testing. You know, we had a great event that Wednesday prior to Thanksgiving, where we tested 45 out of 50 employees at Tudor Ranch in Mecca. And that has, you know, pretty much given us a lot of goodwill with the growers. You know, it was a very successful event. You know, George Tudor, the president of Tudor Ranch, spoke very highly of the event and how easy it was to implement the event, and it did not disrupt his operations there at the farm. So hopefully we'll have a couple of other growers, you know, joining us to give us access to their site. And we're also working with labor contractors, which we know, you know, provide the workforce, you know, the seasonal workforce for a lot of these growers. So we're also working with them to provide information via their paychecks. So we're going to create these little informational packets that are going to be disseminated every Friday with the paychecks to a lot of these farm workers. And we're also scheduling, hopefully, some testing events with these labor contractors. So overall, there's a lot of things happening, you know, with this collaborative. It's been amazing to work with all these community-based organizations. They have, you know, each of them have their, you know, their strong suits and you know, and their, you know, their the relationships established within the community that we're able to leverage for the purposes of this collaborative. So, so far, so good. We've done 3 testing events that have been really successful. So we look forward to doing some more. And then we're going to be starting scheduling on-site testing events like at trailer parks. We have some pending for Mountain View Estates, St. Anthony's Trailer Park, and also San Jose Learning Center there in Oasis. So we'll keep you, you know, up to date on those testing events if you want to come out and see, you know, what happens at these events. It's very tremendous to see what's happening at all of these testing events.
Thank you, Alejandro. I don't know if board members have any questions regarding these activities that we can answer before I talk about the other second part of it.
No, this is Carol. I just wanted to congratulate staff on a wonderful program and the way you've carried it out. It's just so wonderful to hear about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Royer. Eva, do you have any questions?
Thank you, guys. I just wanted to say thank you for all the hard work that I saw that you guys were putting out there in the weekend, and the community from the people that I've spoken to have said that they like that. So they were happy.
Thank you. And I want to acknowledge our new director, Carmina Zavala. She came to help us on Sunday. She was helping with the registration of the patients that were going to be tested. The second part of this update.
Excuse me, this is Carol. I'd like to be notified too. I can come out and help. Let me know.
Sure, absolutely. The second part of this update is regarding an additional fund that we are working to leverage. That's from the Public Health Institute. We're trying to get another $500,000 that we can add to the $1.2 million in the Coachella Valley Equity Fund. And those funds are going to expand the work of the nonprofit organizations that are working with us. And in fact, one of the key activities that we see this is a good opportunity to do is to allocate resources to the organizations that are working with promotoras to do case management and try to remove that layer of bureaucracy from the Department of Public Health and be closer to the community to address in a timely manner their needs once we get the result from a COVID-19 test. We hear that the patient was positive and one of those promotoras is going to call that family and make sure that they get all the help, all the assistance that they need to successfully overcome their COVID-19 infection. Any questions on that?
Does anyone have any questions? No.
Okay.
Thank you, Conrado. We'll move on to number two. Coachella Valley Association of Governments, CVAG, 700,000 letter of intent match for the CV Housing First program. Is anyone going to speak on this? Or I know Greg said he was on the line if we had any questions.
We touched on it a little bit when under the district with the pending grant requests. So there's really nothing much more to add unless Greg wants to add something or Conrado wants to add anything.
Okay, so we'll move on to the number three, the homeless initiative. Is there any new information on this?
No.
Okay. Does anyone have questions about the information provided?
I think it was that was just there as a placeholder in case there was anything new that came up.
Oh, okay. Then we'll move on to number four, update, advancing the district's role in addressing the healthcare needs of Black communities in the Coachella Valley. Is there anything new on this, Conrado?
Yes, we had, as you know, we received the proposal. And there is a staff report on the packet, right?
Yes.
So there is a staff report on the packet that outlines what I'm about to say. We received one proposal from a qualified applicant. We invited the community members, and we had Dieter Crawford and Grace Gardner representing Desert Highland Gateway. They participated in reviewing that grant application. We had a meeting with the applicant, which was the Desert Age project. We also invited our program committee chair, Yvette Perez-Gills. She also participated in that meeting. And we were able to ask very meaningful questions from that applicant and their proposal. The feedback that we had from our community members was that the proposal did not meet the expectations, the needs, the desires of the community. Therefore, the recommendation was to reject that application and to reopen the RFP and seek additional applicants that can bring another proposal that is going to be more responsive to the needs of the Desert Highland Gateway States community. Any questions?
This is Carol. What specific needs are you looking at that's that we need to expand on?
Access to healthcare. That was the specific need. The proposal did not clearly outline how the activities that they were proposing were going to provide meaningful access to healthcare. I believe there is a stigma challenge there that was not addressed. And the modality of access to healthcare that was proposed, the community members believe they were not meaningful. They were not what they wanted. They proposed bringing one nurse that would do screenings and then refer those cases to DAP's clinic, which is a couple miles away. But we already know the community has told us that they don't want to go to a place that it's associated with AIDS and HIV, that there is a stigma associated with the name. And instead of creating an access point outside of their four walls, they chose to create a proposal that would have someone selling the services, and then that would magically change the perceptions of the community and bring them into their four-wall clinic. There was also part of the proposal was hiring promotoras from that community, part-time, no benefits, something that was not well received by the community members. Why were they limiting their funding for those community members, while at the same time they were proposing to do huge another needs assessment, paying good money to another organization that was not ingrained in the in that community. So those were some of the feedback that we received from the community, and that's why our recommendation, which is their recommendation, to reject that proposal and to reopen the RFP.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Okay. Does anyone else have any questions about this? Hearing none, we'll move on to B, expanding racial diversity and health professional workforce, 100,000, One Future Coachella Valley, and African American Healthcare Student Scholarships. Is there any new information on this item?
Donna?
Yeah. Yes, we did get the scope of work from One Future. It's been reviewed by Megan and I and Conrado, and we have a meeting scheduled for next week to go over the scope of work and with some recommended changes and revisions and questions we will have with One Future.
Okay, that's all thank you. Okay, thank you, Donna. Does anyone have any questions for Donna? Hearing none, we'll move on to the grant payment schedule. I can't open up my scene. Does anybody have any questions about the grant payment schedule? No one? Hearing none, we'll move on to, I lost my agenda, sorry.
Committee member comment.
Okay, so we'll move on to committee member comments. Does anybody have any committee member comments? No? Hearing none, we'll move to adjourn at 1:44 p.m. Thank you all for your help.
Thank you.
Have a nice day.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.